Welcome to Venturi's Voice. Join me as I chat with big thinkers, decision makers, and leaders in the world of tech. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Sean Travers, who is CTO, Digital Savings at Investec. It's great to have you join us today. Thanks for taking the time to carve an hour out of your day to spread some wisdom for us.
Hopefully.
So I think, just to get the ball rolling, could you give us a bit of insight into Investec and what your role is there?
Sure. Investec is actually an international bank and wealth manager, founded in South Africa in 1974. It's grown to about 9,000 people now worldwide, across 40 cities in five continents. So quite a big organization. So in terms of how I came to being, I joined Investec in 2012, during an exciting time actually for the bank. Investec UK were bringing to market their first transactional banking product called Voyage. So my initial role was a software engineer, and I was brought in as a contractor. But it was an easy decision for me to switch to a permanent role once I seen what type of organization Investec was and where it was going from a tech perspective. So I had various roles over the 8 years, from a software engineer to team lead. I ended up being in the position of head of engineering for a period, and I ended up then as a heading up technology for digital savings.
Excellent. That's quite like a linear way to progress, isn't it?
It's pretty linear. Like once I got to London, I think my career went in the directory I would have liked from the beginning. But yeah, it was part to do with the environment that I was kind of thrown into.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, I have a lot of leaders in technology, and a lot of them make the move to London because that seems to be kind of the tech hub of the UK. Would you say that it's really important to kind of move to a big city if you want to work in technology?
It's interesting you say that. I think with COVID, the onset of COVID, I probably would have said yes, absolutely, come to London to start this year. You need to know if you want to accelerate your career, it makes sense because everything's at your fingertips from all of the meetups, the conferences, to even the authorities in each space. A lot of them are in proximity to London, so they're easily accessible. But what we've seen now is COVID's come along and said, it's a work anywhere mentality, and actually everybody's accessible virtually quite easily now, and conferences are gone online. So there's less of a reason for you to say come to London, I would say, which is interesting.
Definitely. Right, so, we've been talking a little bit before this podcast, and it sounds like you've gone through quite a big journey at Investec over the last 12 months. I think it'd be quite interesting if we could hear a little bit about that and kind of why you did it and what the journey was, essentially.
Yeah, look, it's been a crazy one. So it's like last year, as a business, we were looking at trying to get a handle on our operating costs. So what our accountants talk to us as our jaws ratio was actually closing, which is a bad thing. It's basically talking about our income, not where it should be, and our operating costs are actually increasing. We had more control over operating costs from a technology perspective, and we knew we had kind of inherent problems, mainly a combination of kind of legacy systems, traditional silos, inhibited us from like truly innovating and delivering at pace. And it actually put it was difficult for us to put any significant dent, I would say, in our operating costs with our incremental improvements that we were making. So we've seen, digitalization as a mechanism to kind of course correct dramatically. So in the middle of last year, we set ourselves a big kind of hairy, audacious goal of architecting bringing to market first a kind of a compelling product in the savings space, but also as well as that from a tech perspective, it was actually creating an architecture that supports this, that allows us to kind of innovate, deliver at pace, and actually deliver it at a very reasonable cost. So yeah, it's pretty cool. I think as well as that, the the approach from an organization where we're coming from, I'd say, even still in parts, we're very much a kind of private cloud infrastructure as a service operation. We traditionally would have dedicated teams to look after infrastructure, and then we'd have delivery teams that sit and kind of rely heavily on these infrastructure teams. This whole way of working, I would say, in this new space where digital savings have kind of sat themselves into, meant that we, like the team, like owned their stuff from top to bottom, and the I suppose the cloud native approach allowed us to do that. So we introduced our infrastructure as code, which allowed us to, I suppose, build our resources within AWS and manage that infrastructure within the team, as opposed to having to have an external dependence in a team that's looking after that infrastructure. That was very much a kind of a move away from where we traditionally were. So it did kind of represent a bit of a gamble. We were kind of going in this as very much as an experiment. We weren't sure it was going to work. But from an engineering perspective, it was really exciting because we were kind of on the cusp of this type of work, and the opportunity, I suppose the engineers took it with both hands. Owning their space from top to bottom is something that really appeals to engineers. I would say you build it, you run it, you own it. That's what we tried to embody within the team, and I think we've had reasonable success in doing so. The other part as well, in terms of that journey, was a big thing, was actually scaling this. So the digital savings business within Vestec is probably the area of the business that we could kind of say requires a reasonable amount of scale. We were basically a high net worth individual business when it comes to banking, and it basically focused on a very small subset of the population, not me. In the savings business, we're very much kind of mass affluent, so we look at the likes of me or you who are looking to save money, so we can funnel that money into the high net worth space so we can lend to them. So we need to make this I suppose area scale, and as our liquidity needs increase, we need to kind of bring in new money direct to client kind of cash into the bank. So it's quite I would say spiky. So our infrastructure needs to represent this type of spiking. So we've set that out. In today's business, or the current traditional business from a savings perspective, we could bring in a number of applications a day, like hundreds, but we had to support that with a lot of manual kind of operational teams that are kind of supporting in the background, making sure these apps get opened. In the new world, this was fully automated. And digitalization allowed us to do that because we were actually building a new product, like rewriting all the operational processes and building a new technology stack to support it, as opposed to just trying to automate everything in terms of how we've done it traditionally, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, one thing I've kind of realized over the past few years, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I could be, you know, but I've found that, I mean, would you say that digital savings as an industry and the kind of banking industry is quite slow on the uptake with tech, or do you think that they're kind of on the pulse with it?
It depends. We've got certain players that have taken the bull by the horns, and you can see that they're really cornering the market. I think it's like the I suppose in the current climate, I think people are more digital savvy and are more likely to go to a product. Let's be honest, the savings business is very, very, it's kind of interest rate sensitive, but there are also other factors. I think client experience, the fact that you're digital native, does attract a certain type of clientele. Like the actual client experience where it's seamless and it takes literally minutes actually does have a bearing on whether people open their accounts with you. So in general, I would say you're probably right in terms of, I think there are certain players that are just way behind the curve and are very, very traditional in terms of how they onboard clients and how they support a client base. But there definitely are players out there that are doing things, I think, in a kind of truly digital native way, like Investec are now.
And I've been thinking, like, it's almost, you know, in the past I'd have thought, oh, it's risky to make these big changes. But then it's actually, in this day and age, it's a risk not to make these changes and develop.
Like, as I said, the course correction was something that, like, this wasn't something that we could even dawdle on. We knew we needed to make it, and make it we did. there was a bit of risk associated with it, because it was basically going into a bit of an unknown for the bank specifically. But yeah, we got there in the end. But it was, I do agree, it was something that we couldn't say, no, let's just ignore this for another year. So we need to just take the bull by the horns.
Yeah, and you've managed to turn that round really quickly. I mean, under a year. What would you say some of the pitfalls have been on this big change?
Well, the obvious one probably is COVID. I would say COVID-19. I think at the time the team itself set some lofty goals in terms of how quickly we can get to market. COVID hit, and there was a lot of uncertainty at the time. But in true style, we actually turned this into an opportunity. I think the whole mantra of continuous feedback and our use of retrospectives meant that we could kind of recontract how the team works with each other. Which was great. So we switched, I suppose, our ways of working into more an asynchronous style, which kind of helped us. And an actual fact, you talk to any of the team members in digital savings, they'll tell you that our productivity has improved. And actually the new asynchronous style of working allows for periods where life gets in the way. So we have a lot more flexibility in terms of when we do our work, which has been a positive. What else? Yeah, there was a big one. There was one where I suppose the whole mantra for the approach, we talk about what we did here, and it was basically kind of Lego banking type of approach, rent and assemble. We looked at best of breed vendors. We pulled them together and brought to market, I think, a compelling proposition that's slick, it's secure, it's transparent, and it's great from an onboarding perspective. But the mantra was we were going to go after the vendors who are innovating most and were kind of market leaders. But like you know yourself, I think this kind of they jockey for position over the years, and potentially you'll have a clear innovator in the space. We wanted to be able to switch vendors if needs be, the plug and play kind of mantra, right? So we said that was something that we set out as a principle to begin with, but we actually had to engage on that principle just before we were going to go live, which wasn't ideal timing, but we put it into practice. So we looked at a particular vendor. It turned out that they weren't part of our strategic plans. We had to pivot. From the team's perspective, we did that in like blazingly fast time. We switched, and it was not a big deal. The bottleneck actually was pushed down to, I suppose, factors that are outside the team. But we managed to literally switch it out really, really quickly, which talked to, I suppose, our ways of working, the technology, the patterns that we'd actually implemented were working as we'd expect. I suppose there's nothing else. I think on board, like the challenges for us was probably onboarding. I think we were set up as a startup within a corporate, and we took that mindset. We were a product team. We were truly kind of T-shaped. We separated the role from the soul. Yeah, have you ever heard that term?
I've not heard that actually.
We were looking from. We had a big hairy audacious goal, and we were kind of purely focused on that. So it just meant that team players were just, you know, rolling up the sleeves wherever they could to actually deliver towards that outcome. So yes, you had your deep specialization, but we were there for the team and we needed team players in place. But that kind of that ideal was a bit of a challenge when it came to onboarding people. So when we brought new people in, it was such a fast-paced environment, and we expected people to, I suppose, to be learning on the job and delivering. And I think it was quite a challenge for some people that came on that journey with us. And I think because we didn't spend enough time on the kind of how we onboard people, we didn't always get it right. But I think from that perspective, we did course correct eventually, and we kind of came up with a model of how we'd onboard people going forward. But unfortunately, it wasn't there for the people that had to kind of run the gauntlet at the beginning.
Yeah, that's interesting. So obviously, I say this all the time, the tech is moving at the speed of light. So we know that, right? So I'm just thinking, over the last 12 months even, has there been any tech innovations that have made a difference to the project that have come out in the last 12 months?
Has there been any? Like, I suppose when it comes to, I would say, strong customer authentication, like we basically have a web journey. We kind of take an approach, did I mention I don't think I did. We took a kind of a design thinking approach at the very outset. We went through an ideation phase. We did some prototyping to begin with, and we figured out what worked and what didn't work. But one thing that we kind of resonated with the people that we kind of literally footstepped on the street about a savings product was an app wasn't that important when you're opening up a savings product. Actually, in most cases, for some reason, it's a psyche that people, when they're moving large amounts of money, generally would use a desktop.
Interesting. Yeah,
it's an interesting kind of insight. But as well as that, when you open up a savings account, I don't think people want, like, crowded on their phone an app that they only open once a year. So that kind of design thinking led us down the way of saying we're just going to go web to begin with, and we iterate towards potentially an app as a fast follower. So in that sense, we're stuck with strong customer authentication. And when we look at what innovations are happening there, where you've basically got access to the native functions of a device without having an app when it comes to you authenticating who you are, offers up some really, really interesting opportunities for people who don't want to have an app, and that's growing all the time. I still think it's a bit cutting edge. We've got some companies like Trusana who are innovating in that space. Whether that's something that we could use in future remains to be seen. It's still a bit bleeding edge, but it does represent some really cool opportunities for teams and I suppose companies that are kind of will go in our direction, where we say we just want a pure native solution and leveraging a browser rather than kind of building an app, because we know there's lots and lots of pitfalls of building an app. You could go into a state of yak shaving. What are you trying to deliver? We're trying to bring in funds into the bank, and we end up 12 months trying to build an app. So it's interesting. So that for me is quite cool. And I think from a payments perspective, I think the open banking space is always quite interesting. I think from a funding perspective, we're always looking at ways of reducing friction when you're trying to fund your account. We know at the moment it's a bit of a faff, right? You open up a savings account, you'll get your circled account number, then you have to go and copy and paste it over into your other bank account, and you then set up a beneficiary and all that faffing that has to go. You have to do your strong customer authentication, and before you know it, it's 20 minutes have gone and you're still trying to put money into that account. Open banking and the third parties, the fintech companies that are sitting in that space, reducing all that friction, like, you know, by using QR codes and whatnot, it looks very, very exciting. So in a second, you'll have that account funded and all that friction disappears. From our perspective, it's great because we don't want to have balances sitting at zero. We want that money in. And the client just wants to fund the account so they can start earning interest. So it's a mutually beneficial exercise.
So is it fully implemented now into the organization?
Yeah, so we're live since the 21st of October. So it's live. It's a bit of a soft launch. We're slowly ramping up marketing. So we're starting to see that manifest in accounts opening. But it also kind of talks to, I suppose, the operating cost piece, which I mentioned from the outset. The why we're doing it in the first place is to kind of manage our costs. So with us going cloud native, I mentioned we're in AWS. We had an opportunity while we just turned it on in a soft launch to say, actually, how much is this costing us from an infrastructure perspective by just, you know, turning on the tap? And it's been quite interesting to see it from a production perspective. It's costing us $9 a day when we're actually putting through any apps. So it's literally you could tap with your debit card how much it's costing us. So it's showing us that, like, you know, with a cloud native approach, you can scale up, but you can also scale down, which is what we're trying to achieve from the outset. So that's also been an interesting insight for us.
Yeah. So you've nailed it, basically. You've ticked every box and it's all working. I shouldn't jinx it.
I'd say it's still early doors. I don't want to tempt fate. Touch wood.
Luckily I've got a wooden desk, so I'm touching this now. So I'm just thinking, like, if you had the option to go back, to rewind time to 12 months ago when you started this project, is there anything that you'd do differently if you had the chance to?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I would say that, okay, if I went back knowing the exact same things I did 12 months ago, what would it, is that what you mean by that question? Okay. So I think I would probably, the big one for me is probably around automated UI testing. Like we kind of made it, it's all about trade-offs. And we made a call, like, yes, we have automated UI testing, but just probably not enough. And we've taken this mantra of the kind of separate the role from the soul, which kind of, in this instance, kind of meant that we just had more people doing manual testing, which is great when we're all kind of rolling in behind it. We actually got to market pretty quick, but if we don't pay it, then that's technical debt. It's essentially going to slow us down, and our cadence will essentially just grind slower and slower to a halt. So we started to pay down that technical debt, but it's probably something I would have mandated from the outset if I was to start our UI testing needed to be in place. I mentioned onboarding. I think we kind of lashed into the kind of the work, and I didn't think about, you know, it's going to be very soon where we're going to have to have our first set of recruits, and how do we onboard? I think being more deliberate in our organization, in our kind of planning, we should have put something down around onboarding and how that would work, and actually from a technical perspective, how we kind of get people into the stretch zone and not the panic zone. I think we've seen where we're like, okay, this is everything that we've done, and it's like a huge architectural diagram, and people just literally crap themselves. So like, okay, this is complicated. But that's not the approach. It's like, okay, we kind of slowly introduce them, get them productive really quickly without kind of scaring the living daylights out of them. And I think the spec was an interesting one for me. I think the spec that we've written for the engineers to begin with, we're looking for full stack people. We realized that it was pretty much a unicorn that we're looking for, because there were so many technologies that we had to take. Having a big list of technologies on your CV, I think in this day and age, potentially scares away potential candidates. And we've actually seen it in our current configuration, that there's people that came in just on aptitude, and they've just blown the lights out. It's been amazing. And if you looked at them in black and white on a resume, there's no way you would have said that this person is going to be a highly performing member of the team. So it's all about aptitude. So I think we probably be a bit more careful in the wording of the role description to ensure that we get people that are not scared off. And we all know, if you want a diversity of thinking, you need to get that diversity within a team. And if you have a big list and say must have required skill sets, you might be just driving a particular type of person into that team. So it's, you know, you live, you learn. So it's all a way of shaping your future. And I think that's one thing that I probably would look at if I start again.
So it was a new challenge a year ago. So how do you go about avoiding bottlenecks, the dreaded bottlenecks, in such a new, you know, challenge that you're working on? How do you know where they're going to be, and how do you know how to avoid them? Or is it kind of reactive?
It's the bottlenecks for me, it's a bigger systemic problem. It probably talks to organizational change. And like you may have heard the term Conway's Law. I think in Investec, we are looking at addressing, I suppose, team boundaries. And that's the most important thing, right? We've got, there's a book that came out in the last 12 months around team topologies, which has been really groundbreaking for Investec. It looks at solving some of these problems. Team boundaries are quite important. And I suppose naming or calling out what the team's purposes are, like they're general, I would say, archetypes for teams. And in some cases, they might be aligned to a particular stream. In other cases, they're a platform team. So in the case of what the digital saving space is, it's firmly in a stream enabled team. So you're setting up your other teams to, I suppose, platform teams should be self-serving. So that you come to them and they're like a SaaS that you go, like a Twilio, where you just go and you read the documentation and you just crack on. There's very little friction in terms of, I suppose, bottlenecks. You basically self-serve, the documentation is there, and you just need to, you just need to read it.
Right. Okay.
But that's the dream. Okay. That's how ultimately you'll have these teams that are, you know, their mantra is just to get features out as quickly as possible, and deliver an amazing client experience and align to a particular business objective. Your other teams are then set up to ensure that they can meet those objectives by being self-serve. But it's, yeah, that is very much a journey we've only started on. But yeah, trying to locally optimize on bottlenecks, from my experience, is a bit of a waste of time. I think you just become frustrated. You need to look at a more systematic change in order to have a tr- I suppose a true impact on that problem itself.
Yeah. So, say, like, obviously you've just a year ago you took on this new challenge. So I'm interested in where you'd find inspiration, or what's your go-to resource to kind of learn about what you're about to do, or kind of think about a plan.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Like, I would say I would start off actually probably internally. I think Investec has great people. I think a big part of why I was attracted to Investec was its focus on people. The engineering culture within Investec is just going from strength to strength. So I have a very strong internal network available to me. But external to that, like, I've 15 years now. I'm in over 15 years in software engineering. It's brought me from Boston, Dublin, and then finally in London. I've got a big network there where it spans many industries. So I have a lot of people to just, you know, nudge and say, what are you thinking of this? But particularly for what we did with the digital savings kind of pivot, I was looking to conferences. I was looking to authorities in the space, or I would say companies and banks that I would measure where we should be at in terms of Investec, and looking to see how they do things and using that. There is lots of kind of areas that I'm a big fan of Simon Wardley and Wardley mapping. So looking at how he dissects problems like this was really helpful for me. The conferences, like, are amazing. It's like, you know, I've been attending QCon every year since I came to London. I go to a lot of the fintech conferences to kind of look for insights and ideas. And then you've got the online learning. So online learning for me, again, I kind of mentioned the async approach to working, but learning, it's equally as important. So sites like Udemy, Pluralsight, InfoCube, all of these are just really, really kind of rich kind of treasure troves of information where you can then, I suppose, look for inspiration in terms of how you go about building a digital savings bank from scratch. It's very, very, very scary to begin with, but, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of giants, and all these people that are around you, you're basically incrementing, you're looking for ideas and borrow bits here and then actually take it into the context of Investec and say, how can it work? And that's how it's been done. I certainly didn't do it on my own.
yeah. Right, so I've got a bit of a difficult question here that I'm going to throw at you. What would you say the cheapest investment you've made in your career is that's returned with the highest return of investment? Sorry.
Yeah, but what was it? I suppose, like, you could probably pick on a Pluralsight license, because I started off as a contractor. I kind of was thrown into a kind of a very, very high-paced environment when I came to. I'm not an advocate for Pluralsight. I would just say generally, like, online. There's lots of online learning platforms. Like, when I came to the UK, I was thrust into this team. There were just some amazing engineers around me, and I just felt that I had to get up to speed quickly. And how do you do that? One of them was just investing in paying for some online learning, and then literally immersing yourself in training when you had the time, like in the afternoons and evenings. Like, I think as an engineer, you need to be passionate. And I think when you're passionate about something, it's probably the people around you are probably suffering, because you're just like completely going for this goal, and just burying yourself into that and having the means to be able to do it. Like, having these online platforms allow you to do it in an async manner, to get up to speed where you need to, and then be able to apply it in your environment is the holy grail. So it was quite a cheap investment for me, and I think it did pay dividends. I was able to catch up where I was needed to catch up, and I did it off my own back.
Cool. If you think back to when you moved to the UK, I mean, you know, in London, obviously people are saying there's more opportunities, but then with that, there's more competition. So did you find it harder to break into the industry, or was it easier?
It's a difficult one for me to answer, because essentially when I was in Dublin, I actually met my future hiring manager with the bank. So like that guy actually sold it to me about London, and was like, you'd be perfect for what I need. So I was very lucky to be able to come into that. I think, yeah, the market is definitely tougher. It will probably get even tougher, because definitely. I think with COVID, I suppose those, your borders just disappear, and you're now looking after you're in a pool of global engineers, which might be a bit disheartening for folks. But I think ultimately you need to back yourself and back your brand, and you know, if you're really truly passionate about something, you can follow that. You know what I mean? You've got really no excuses. You can a small bit of investment, as you said, in yourself, in your training, hoping that you're working in an environment that allows you to apply some of that learning, will mean that you yourself can build a brand and kind of compete with a global pool of engineers. So I lifted outside of London now, because I think that's going to just slowly dissipate.
Cool. I think that might be a nice point to end on, actually, a bit of advice there. Very good. I mean, that's very, very interesting. Is there anything you particularly want to mention, maybe a bit of advice for people, or anything at all?
For me, I think I look back at my career, and it's like I would say just be patient in finding the right role. I think I would say my role, probably my I suppose career probably stagnated a bit in Dublin, because I kind of rushed into taking a position, and then that coupled with inertia just meant that I stayed in a role for just too long. I didn't feel it went anywhere. I think I mentioned already, I moved to London, and I think my career then eventually started to move in the direction I wanted to move in, but it could have happened a lot earlier if I was just a little bit more patient, I think, and backed myself and said, okay, I can get a better position than this. That was one. And then I suppose be wary of imposter syndrome. I think it took me quite a while to get comfortable with my own skin. And I think it's okay to say you don't know something. And I think it was a big problem for me switching from engineer to leader. I really kind of suffered in silence for fear of being found out. But it just, you know, hindsight is like, you know, it's a two-way street, and it's within your power to kind of manage expectations when you're taking a role. That's really it. I'd say identifying when you're moving into those positions, identify a mentor. That will probably give you every chance of success, and it's okay. You don't need to kind of suffer on your own. And just, yeah, it's okay to say.
Excellent.
You don't know.
Excellent. Honestly, Sean, I could literally sit here and chat to you all day. But I'm sure you've got a very busy lifestyle to maintain, even in lockdown.
Two kids are looking after that, all right, for sure.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.